Have you ever wondered what life is like for refugees and immigrants in the U.S.? We're going to be talking about the experiences of Tibetan Americans today with our guests. Hi, I'm Jill Najow. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. With me is Madeline Uranek and Jampa Ketup. Madeline is an educator and writer who has visited 64 countries through her role as International Education Consultant for the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction and several Peace Corps assignments and her passion for world travel. Jampa is an associate lecturer at UW-Madison. He teaches modern Tibetan in the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. We're talking about Madeline's new book. It's called How to Make a Life, a Tibetan Refugee Family and the Midwestern Woman that They Adopted. Jampa is part of that extended family and teaches at the Wisconsin Tibetan Association Saturday School of Tibetan Language and Culture. Have you helped a refugee or immigrant family adjust to living in the U.S.? What questions do you have about Tibet and its culture? Well, we'd like our listeners to be part of our conversation, so give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Madeline, Jampa, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Hi, thank you very much.
You bet. Now, Madeline, let's start with you. Now, you have known this Tibetan family for quite a while. Why did you decide that now was the time to write their story?
Well, I came back to Madison having traveled and worked abroad for 7 years, and I had accumulated countries through work and adventure, and I said I wanted to write, and people thought I would write about my travel experiences around the world. As I thought about it, though, there was one country that I had really made a huge impression on me, and that was Tibet. And that's odd, because of all the countries that I've traveled in, Tibet was not one of them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the reason that it happened was that in the early 1990s, I met a woman who was a Tibetan refugee, Tenzing Kelsang is her name, and she's still here in Madison, working today, not in the studio with us, unfortunately. And I had met her at work. She was on the cleaning crew, and over 20 years, I got to know her and her family, and I just learned so much about her culture.
Now, how did she come to the U.S.? What was that process like for her?
In 1990, after a lot of many, many years of lobbying of people who were interested in human rights and the Tibetan cause, and numerous visits by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, there was passed an Immigration Act. It was a very short in time. It was introduced by U.S. Representative Barney Frank from Massachusetts, and the United States at that point accepted 1,000. Tibetan refugees via a lottery. And they didn't know what to call them, you know, because refugees means you're going to get some kind of a welfare for a very short period of time in the U.S. And they weren't immigrants, because we have immigrant quotas.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they ended up calling them displaced Tibetans. They drew 1,000 names from 15,000 people who ended up applying. And then they were sent in just a brilliant refugee resettlement plan to different communities. Started out being 10, and then it was 16 and 22, where people were knowledgeable about what was Tibet and what was Tibetan Buddhism, university communities or places where there might already be a Tibetan Buddhist temple. And Madison was one of those.
Okay. Jampa, was your situation similar? Did you come to the U.S. in the same kind of process?
Well, my case is a little different. I didn't come part of the, 1,000 immigration bill passed, but I came on a religious visa. Because there is the Buddhist temple, Deer Park Buddhist Center, right outside Madison. So my teacher was already there at the time. So I came to the States in 1998. So my personal teacher was already there at the center as a resident teacher. So I finished my studies, higher Buddhist studies in Sarah J. Monastic University back in India. And then I decided to come and join him here at the center to, you know, to be the resident, you know, the translator, because my teacher spoke only Tibetan.
Oh.
So, yeah, I came as, you know, as a assistant, and then also to, you know, help at the center too, with the, you know, on a daily kind of activities and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, most people listening probably are familiar with recent Tibetan history. But you could you remind us why Tibetans have become refugees, Champa? I know it's hard to condense it.
Yeah, I mean, it all started, you know, in 1959. 1959, March 10, what happened was that the Chinese military presence was already there in Tibet, you know, way before 59. But around the 1959 March, in the beginning of March, then there were more presence of military and then of Chinese military. And they invited His Holiness the Dalai Lama to a performance, you know, like a gathering to their military camp. And so now the Tibetan, you know, the people were worried that, that you know, the Chinese military will, you know, detain His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And then people, you know, just all the thousands of people ran into, you know, towards the Nobilunga Palace so that, you know, they can protect the Dalai Lama. And the people didn't want His Holiness to go to the, you know, the performance or the gathering. So that was the incident happened in March 1959, and then they realized that, you know, it's not going to be a good, you know, situation. So the Dalai Lama decided to escape, you know, flee Tibet and escape into India. So March 10, around the first week of March started, and then on the March 17, they, you know, start the horrifying, you know, escape into India, which took almost 14 to 15 days, you know, over the Himalayas. And so, yeah, it all started from there. And then once the people realized that the Dalai Lama was already, you know, escaped into the Indian border, then people just, you know, started following him. And then as of now, I would say there are about 140 to 150, you know, Tibetans living outside Tibet, in like India, Nepal, Bhutan, and then all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the Tibetan refugee started, you know, from there, where the Dalai Lama has to escape because of the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1959.
Okay. Thank you. That was great, because I know it's a very complicated subject, obviously. Now, Madeline, the family that you are talking about was part of this trek. I mean, it's much longer than that, to India. What was that like for them?
The father, Mi'kmaq Dorji, came as a 13-year-old. There were, I think, a massive uprising. There was also massive killings. There were destruction of the monasteries, imprisonment of monks. And his own brother was a minor official in a neighboring town. And when the Chinese officials began identifying particular public officials to be publicly humiliated, possibly imprisoned, possibly killed, they decided that they would also have to flee. So in the dead of night, three families, his family and his brother's families, his older brothers were already married, fled in a snowstorm across the mountain. He was only 13, and they're staggering in huge drifts. And in the process of this horrific snowstorm, which may have saved their life in that the Chinese soldiers could not follow them, they got to a point where they decided they would pull a tent out of the yaks and stay for the night. And in that process, the yaks they had, seven of them, I think of, I can't quite remember now whether it was 12, 15, turned around and kept going back down to the village. So they lost food, tents, all of their family heirlooms. And I think that was very typical of people. They started, they carried what they could. good and precious, precious things from these libraries, I guess, are still turning up as people maybe buried them or hid them on the way out. But they did descend to the other side, and there's many chapters after that of work camps and
things like that. Not an easy journey, to say the least. Our guests today are Madeline Uranek, author of the book How to Make a Life, A Tibetan Refugee Family and the Woman They Adopted, and Jampa Ketup, an associate lecturer at UW-Madison. He teaches modern Tibetan. If you'd like to join in, we'd love to hear from you. What do you want to know about the Tibetan culture? Or maybe you have an experience with immigrants or refugees. We'd like to hear your story. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Right now, we are talking about the story of Tibetan Americans here in the Madison area and in general. Madeline, you talked about Tenzin's, how she got here, but then how did the rest of her family get to Madison?
That's right. When the story I was just mentioning of fleeing over the Himalayas, the people who did that now tend to be elders, although Jampa has a story. And their amazing stories are being collected as part of oral history projects. Tenzin herself, the wife who married Mi'kmaq, was one of many who was born in the refugee camps. So when these hundreds of thousands of refugees poured over the mountains, literally walking into the country, the government of India, and working with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, set up 47 refugee settlements, which have been called some of the world's most successful refugee settlements. One of them was in Bailakupe, which is in the south of India, in the state of Karnataka.
You said it better than I would.
different pronunciation. And so she was born there, one of the first babies born in the new settlement. And they were set up as cooperatives, and they had farming and rug weaving, and they were seen as, from the beginning, as that they wouldn't integrate into Indian culture, that they would remain separate with their language and culture. And they're fascinating places to visit today.
Jampa, did you grow up in one of the settlements? Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I was born there in South India. Uh-huh. After my parents, you know, followed His Holiness Dalai Lama, and all the way down in the South India. So I was born there and raised there. I would say maybe one of the first generation in, you know, the Tibetans in exile.
What was it like living in the settlements?
Well, in the beginning, it was very hard, you know, life there because of the economy and all that. Indian government have, you know, provided the farming, you know, agriculture land and all that. But then we have to kind of, you know, learn and how to do the, you know, farming. And also we have to do a lot of, you know, land, you know, I would say deforesting because of, you know, we were given the land, and then we have to kind of, you know, make it livable for us as, you know, for the hundreds of Tibetans, hundreds and hundreds of Tibetans there. So it was, yeah, a harsh beginning, but then, you know, gradually it got better, sure, yeah.
And I would imagine it was kind of difficult for the people who moved from Tibet, where the weather and growing conditions are completely different from southern India.
Yeah, I mean, for us, as a, you know, those who were born there, is a little different because we got acclimated to the, you know, climate and all
right.
that. But for our parents, you know, definitely they had a very hard time because of the, you know, the climate temperature and all that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they had way more difficulties than, you know, the ones that were born there.
Right.
So they have to do all the hard works. You know, that generation, you know, had to do all the works for us to. Yeah.
Definitely. Now, Madeline, we didn't get to how the rest of the family came over. So what was that process like?
So if you come over as a refugee immigrant, you have a period of years, 3, 4, 5 years, and you are allowed to file a family reunification visa. So Tenzin Kelsang came, and she just worked so hard, unbelievably hard. She had 3 jobs. She had a day job. She had a night job, and on the weekend she had a weekend job. So I really didn't know it was possible for people to work so hard and sleep so little, but she did that in order to save money and file this visa, reunification visa, and that's where I helped her. I was working in my office after hours, and she would come along and say, can you help me fill out these forms? And so it actually took almost 5 years, because after the visa's filed, and there's a lot of delays, and there were a lot of cancellations of flights, but they came over these 1,000, they call them the lucky 1,000, came over in batches, and she was one of the last batches that came over in small groups, 30, 40, went to different towns and arrived. And Madison had a very successful Tibetan resettlement project. So 1 year, I think, Jampala, correct me if I'm wrong, but there were 100 Tibetans in Madison who were becoming citizens, learning English, working hard, saving money. And then the next year, I think it's the difference between 92 and 93, or 93 and 94, there were 400,
oh,
because they all brought children at the same time. Those are very joyous reunions. So all of a sudden, I had known Tenzin Kelsang, and then suddenly there were four teenagers who stepped off the Van Galder bus one night with their father.
So all of a sudden, we've got this huge family, I mean, compared to just single. So how did the younger kids, how old were they when they came over?
The youngest one was in fifth grade,
okay.
Tardo.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what was that like for them? Because they had to go to school.
Immediately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they arrived in March, and the school year was almost up. And I was just fascinated how on earth was the Madison Public Schools going to catch them up in English, and at the same time, how could they keep some of their Tibetan culture and language? To me, those seem just completely opposite. So the real heroines in this struggle are the English as a second language teachers all throughout the United States, who get these kids from different countries, different cultures, different reasons that they've come, all different levels of proficiency, some not speaking a word. Others of them have had English in their school. Laden, the girl in the family, had actually been studying English in India. And somehow catch them up with their peers or give them an education so they can graduate from high school.
I thought one of the most unusual things that I didn't think about is that when you tried to register them, names are not the same here as they are with the Tibetan people. So it was a little difficult as far as, you know, well, where's the last name and where's the... Why don't you explain maybe, Jampa, a little bit about how the names are a little different than here in the West? Or
well, I mean, I think many of the other, you know, cultures, their names does carry like meanings in, you know, in their names.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly Tibetan names have almost all the names, I would say pretty much, carries a meaning that is either, you know, tied with the religion, you know, the religious concept, or, you know, the cultural religious concept into that. So some of the names, let's say we have, if I say, Sherap,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a wisdom, and my name is Champa, that's a love,
nice.
And yeah, so I'm working on that.
Aren't we all?
And so Sherap, Champa, then what we have? Dolma. We have Dolma. That's a liberator. You know, it's a Dolma. It's a female. You know, the liberator, but Dol meaning to liberate, and then Tenzing. Mm-hmm. Which is a very common name. It's a very large number of Tibetans will have, you know, their first name or Tenzin something so and so, because of His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama's name is Tenzin Gyatso. Right? So that's why many Tibetans carry that. So Tenzin meaning the holder of the, you know, the Buddha Dharma or the Buddhist teaching.
Okay.
Buddha's teaching, yeah.
And then is there a surname, a last name? Usually?
We do, but we don't use as much as like we use here in America. Like when we first come here, like we didn't care about, you know, the last name or family name or, you know, this. So we have like first and middle name. And then often middle name is, you know, treated as a last name because of the order, right? First and
right.
last. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, yeah, some families, they do have a family name. names, but some don't, yeah.
I remember for the mailman, I felt kind of sorry for him delivering mail because I put above the mailbox the list of names of the people in the family. There were six people in the family, the mother, father, and the four kids, and there was no last name. Mm-hmm. So it was Mi'kmaq Dorji and Tenzin Kelsang and, you know, Namgyal Setup and Ladu Nawang, and it goes on like that, but wasn't a last name. I think some of the people who came from the manorial estates who were higher social status might have carried a last name and brought it with them. I think maybe in the beginning they were a little bit surprised that a last name was so important here, and still there will be a family with many names that don't have a last name, so maybe in different generations it'll resolve a little.
I mean, people do have a family name or surname, but it's individual thing whether you like, oh, make a big deal, you know, out of, you know, you want to use the family name or not. You know, some of my brothers, they do. I mean, they used it. And at that time, I was like, oh, you know, no big deal. You know, who am I to say, like, you're having your family name and, you know, having some ties with that. But then coming to America and then, you know, how everything works here, everybody's using that. And now I'm kind of starting to think, like, well, maybe how do I do that now? Going back and adding my family name to my name, right?
So you had a little son, and so what did you do with his name? Does he have a last name?
Yeah, I did it because, you know, my brothers and sisters, you know, especially my brothers, they used it. So then kind of make the connection between my, you know, children and their children so that they will have same, you know, last name or the family name at least, right? Yeah. So now, I did actually use for my son. Yeah.
A lot of immigrants have done that in the past where the names have been changed or simplified, so it's nothing new here in the U.S., I guess. So, now, Madeline, how did you get so involved in this family? I mean, you met this woman at work who came to clean your office. You saw her occasionally, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of this whole family. How did that happen?
It's funny that you asked that, because when I turned in the manuscript for the book, the editor asked the same question. She said, you make this big jump, you know, that you met this lady who's, you know, dusting your cubicle, and then you're in the middle of her family. So she said, you left out a chapter. And I kind of panicked because I had all the stories, but then I remembered in those 5 years that we were waiting for the kids, she was more like an acquaintance. Like, I invited her to canoe the Wisconsin River, or, you know, we did a few things, but she was just working so much in quantity of time, and like a middle-class white American of privilege, you know, I'm doing this, going to concerts and potlucks, and so, you know, we're busy. But over time, I was just fascinated that we were so different in birth and status and culture, but she was a wonderful, engaging person, a great sense of humor, and anyone I introduced her to remembered her and liked her. So we did become friends, but it was mostly because I was an oldest child. I'm bossy, I'm meddlesome, and I was confident as an educator. So as soon as the kids arrived, I started knocking on the door at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock after I was finished from work and they were finished from home, and saying, let's go to the library, let's go to the park, let's, you know, I had lots of ideas.
Okay. We are talking about a new book by our guest, Madeline Uranek. It's called How to Make a Life, a Tibetan Refugee Family and the Woman They Adopted. If you have any questions about Tibetan culture or what it's like to be a refugee, or if you've been a refugee and you want to share that story, please join in. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Jampa, you teach about Buddhism and you spent 25 years as a monk. What part does Buddhism play in the Tibetan culture?
Tibetan culture? I think one of the biggest impact that, you know, the Tibetans have from, you know, practicing Buddhism is that even at a very young age, you know, let's say like 4 or 5 years old kid will simply, you know, have the thought of not killing even the, you know, the smallest insect. you know, they were taught and they were, you know, brought up in that kind of environment, in a family. They, you know, pay so much value to, you know, other animals or the living beings, that everybody deserved to be, like, you know, peace and happiness and all. So, yeah, I think for the youngest, we'll have that impact because of the spiritual kind of practices that and they also brought in the environment where, you know, they're loving and caring and nonviolence, you know, those are all very important, not just for self, but to everybody, you know, everyone that lives in this world. Yeah, so those are some of the, how do you say, the cultural, you know, upbringing that they naturally get that from their parents or from the environment that they live in.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure there's some statistics to back this up, but it seems to me that when people come to another country, religion a lot of times is a unifier among those groups. And then as they get acclimated and generations go, that tends to be not quite as important. Have you seen that at all in the Tibetan community here?
Yeah, I mean, as you relocate, you know, in a new environment and a new country and everything is new to you, you do get kind of, you know, distracted a little bit and then lost some of your background, where you come from, your culture, your traditions and all that. But then from, you know, the importance of the religion or the spirituality, it is more of first paying attention to the basic human values rather than, you know, particular religious faith and tradition.
Oh, okay.
You know, so my priority is kind of, you know, exposing my, you know, children and the young Tibetans to the basic values, you know, before even... Yeah, talking about the importance of the particular religious tradition.
Okay.
So, yeah, get distracted, but then if you teach them or show them or expose them in a way that what is, you know, important in life in a general, you know, in a perspective rather than, you know, going into the particular.
Okay. Oh, well, we actually have some calls here. So let's go to Mary first in Madison. Hi, Mary. What's your question?
Yes, could the speaker give a quick sketch of the terrain, if there's foothills, do they live in foothills of mountains, and what's the primary livelihood? And I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Jampa, do you want to take that question? Do you know, have you been to Tibet?
Well... You see, I was born outside Tibet,
right.
You know, in the exile community, so I've never been to Tibet. So I would love to go and bring my children with me to Tibet. I'm not sure when that's going to happen. You know, I would like that to happen soon, but I've never been there. But from what I, you know, heard from my parents and, you know, from my friends, people do live on, you know, the mountain with the foothills of mountains and also in, you know, there are people actually, you know, living up, not all the way on the top of the mountains, but, you know, but what do you call it? The
valleys,
okay. Yeah, where you can also, you know, do some agriculture, you know, and farming. Yeah.
Is that pretty much the main occupation, is farming?
Oh, the occupation-wise, yeah, there are quite, you know, a large number of farming and lots of, you know, the nomads, actually, you know. They do farming and then also they kind of, you know, travel from, you know, the... one grassland to the next, as just to kind of like keep moving on where they can take care of their cattle.
Seasonal
kind of, yeah. So, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you for that question, Mary. Next we have Virginia. She's calling from Rock County. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I did a little reading because I got interested in the Dalai Lama, and I was shocked to learn that before the Chinese came, Tibet was a theocracy, just like Iran or Saudi Arabia. It was the Dalai Lama as a pope. Underneath him were sort of like the Vatican, cardinals, and, you know, I don't know their titles, but they had a very strict theocracy, and the peasants supported it, and women were at the bottom. Just like in Iran, they couldn't pray in front, but they had to have a separate, blah, blah, blah. What my question is, did coming to the USA change the status of women so that their marriages are not arranged and all that sort of thing? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Virginia. You want to talk about that, Champa?
Yes, very good question. So this, the Dalai Lama, is the 14th Dalai Lama. So during the 13th Dalai Lama, you know, at the... in his, you know, the last years during his the 13th Dalai Lama's, you know, lifetime, he wanted to make a big change in the social life of the Tibetan people. He wants to make a big change in terms of how the government is run, you know, how the schools are run, and, you know, the education system and the economy and everything. He wants to make a big, you know, change, being, I would say, more of like, you know, the democratic, you know, kind of going into that direction, right? Uh-huh. The democracy. But then, you know, he was not successful because of so many reasons. And then now the current Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, so in the ancient time, I guess, many of the countries have very similar kind of situation. You know, some of the males are kind of male, like, you know, the dominant, you know, kind of in the society, whereas, you know, female are less, you know, the opportunities in every aspect of your life. But then when you look at the Tibetan community, even in the ancient, you know, Tibetan society or the community, there are many, you know, highly realized, you know, teachers, female, you know, teachers and practitioners. But in a general, of course, yeah, you would see that, you know, women had, you know, less opportunities and privileges in going to schools and education and whatnot. Yeah. But then the modern, at the present time, you know, it's totally different. It has changed a lot as the 13th Dalai Lama visioned and the 14th Dalai Lama carried out, you know, all his, you know, visions. And now women actually have, I would say, you know, same as the men, you know, have privileges, yeah, in education, in the government, you know, staffing and everything, yeah. So when you look at the, you know, the Tibetan, it was used to call Tibetan government in exile, but now it's called the Central Tibetan Administration. If you look at their website, you will see the, you know, the whole picture or the information on how everything is run, yeah.
Okay, that's a good spot to take a look at then, Virginia. Let's go next to Lynn in Spring Green. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning.
What's your question?
Thank you. My question is, first of all, thank you. This program is really relevant to my life. Lived through the Tibetan resettlement times and basically at the same time I had a parallel small Khmer refugee and program going myself. What I would love to hear, what I'd really love the listeners to hear, is what I myself, and now there's a hummingbird joining us, what I myself have experienced, which is the gifts that refugees and immigrants bring to our lives. I could go all day on the gifts that project and the family members that came over here have brought to my life. I'd like to hear that from...
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Lynn.
You're a person.
Sure.
Thanks.
Appreciate that. Madeline, I think you can probably reflect on that question quite well.
Yes, I wrote this book, How to Make a Life, just because the gifts were so enormous in this journey of 20 years that I had with this family. And rather than me helping them, it...
was really reversed, and the gifts they gave me. The first one was is that not knowing my own grandparents and great grandparents, almost so many Americans have immigrants in their family, and I understood how much they had given up to come, and how hard they had worked for us, and how you had to have a burning ideal of freedom or democracy. And I think that burning ideal of freedom and democracy is one of the things that protects freedom and democracy in this country. Another thing that this helped me understand is that there aren't only Tibetans in Tibetan refugees in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Historical Society and the Historical Society Press has chronicled so many immigrant groups that make our culture rich in religion and foods and music and literature and poetry and lullabies and proverbs. And without that, I mean, if you have a monoculture, some countries do have a monoculture, it's just so flat. And I love this layers like geology. Another thing is they really made human rights come home, this wasn't just over there. There were people here in Madison who, you know, had people in jail. There were people here in Madison who were participating in the different human rights protests. And then for me personally, I think all of us may have a few broken parts. For me, I got a family, a godchild. I understood what, not having children before, I understood what it's like to raise teenagers, and there were many issues having nothing to do.
That's a blessing, Madeline?
Nothing to do with being a refugee, but just, they're many great gifts.
And if people want to learn more about Tibetan culture or maybe take part in some things, where can they go to find out more information?
Well, here in Wisconsin, we do have a Tibetan association. It's called Wisconsin Tibetan Association, and there's a website for that, wistib.org.
It's wistib.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And there'll be a whole lot of information and activities or events that's happening here. And pretty soon, in July 6th, we are having His Holiness the Dalai Lama's 83rd birthday. And there will be, you know, a lot of fun stuff, you know, things to do on that. We get together at the monastery here at Deer Park Buddhist Center.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and everyone's welcome for celebration.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's open event, and everyone's welcome. And there's a delicious potluck, you know, dishes, a Tibetan traditional cuisine, yeah.
Interesting. Okay, and Madeline, how do people find out, how do they get your book? And you have a website, right?
I do have a Global Maddie website, www.globalmaddie.com. And the libraries all over the state have it, and book clubs are welcome to read and discuss it, because I think that this is something that touches all of us.
Okay.
In some way.
Well, Madeline and Jampa, this has been a pleasure to talk about. It's such a huge subject, and we'd like to talk more, but our time is up. But thank you so much for being with us today. We've been talking with Madeline Uranek, author of the book How to Make a Life, A Tibetan Refugee Family and the Woman They Adopted, and Jampa Khetup, an associate director lecturer at UW-Madison, where he teaches modern Tibetan in the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at the study of emotions and also how emotions affect culture. Hope you can stay with us on the Ideas Network.